Boy, I'm about my business on business. I drink liquor on liquor. I have women.
I like to imagine, like, because I'm reading a lot about 19th century labor history right now. I like to imagine, like, you know, the old cigar rollers, like Samuel Gompers. They helped to start the American Federation of Labor. I like to imagine that there's a little factory that, like, guys and gals put the little Zin packets together, you know, by hand.
Imagine how mad Tucker Carlson would be if they went on strike.
Oh, is he a big fan?
He's a huge Zin head.
Really?
It's nicotine as a nootropic. It's a performance enhancer. It's catching on. I mean, should have put my 401k in Zin.
Yeah, Zin might be a good investment right now because it's incredibly addictive and you can just, like, give it away to friends and get them addicted.
And it's also, like, just the nicotine, ma'am. Like, it's not even, like, chewing tobacco where there's, like, all sorts of tar and shit in it. It's, like, I think nicotine literally is a nootropic. My great-grandfather used to be, like, used to work in a plant, and he would fix all the machines. And he would tell us stories, like, whenever I ran into a problem, I'd just step back and I'd light a cigarette. And by the time I got to the end of it, problem solved. You know, it's like an old-timey way of, like, getting your bearings, taking a little bit of chemical relief from things, and, like, you know, jump-starting your processes.
That is exactly how I feel when I put one of these things in.
Yeah.
Well, I come from generations of smokers, and it's, like, epigenetics. Like, when I was a kid, I feel like I was born wanting to smoke a cigarette.
Really? You think womb you were?
I think it's just, like, the DNA. Like, I think I got a little, like, packet of information that was, like, you're going to love nicotine. It's just like all of your ancestors.
It's like Dune. Did you guys, have you guys read Dune recently? I'm reading Dune again right now, but, like, the part where they take the spice poison, you know, and the baby in Mother Jessica's stomach, like, gets, like, a shock from the spice and becomes aware. That was you, but with nicotine in the womb.
Nicotine is my spice.
You're like a Ben Gesserit for... I don't know.
That's my lore.
For smoking.
That's my lore. Yeah.
You want to introduce our guest, producer Sean?
Yeah, sure.
AP Sean.
I'm on the ones and twos today. We have today, what are you going by on this?
Jalian.
Jalian. We have today a very special guest. Jalian is in town from the West Coast here in New York City in my apartment sitting alongside AP Andy. And they just got into town and here we are podcasting. So welcome to the show.
Jalian, Twitch viewers might know her as my co-host on Monday morning shows Fandy Service, which we haven't done in a little while, but we'll do it again when the weather gets bad.
Yeah
I don't like to be inside Twitch streaming when it's nice, and people shouldn't be inside Twitch watching when it's nice.
Remember,
get out there and touch some grass.
Remember when Twitch became big? It was in the pandemic.
Exactly.
But I'm with you, man. Like, I couldn't work that much because of the pandemic too, so it was like something to keep occupied. But when the weather's nice, as it is right now in New York, as I'm sure it is in many parts of the world, don't need to be Twitch streaming. You need to be listening to the Antifada on your headphones while enjoying the park or the beach or the mountains or whatever it is you do.
Go to the Palestine occupation camps
and
listen to Antifada when you're there, and then just repeat what we say to people as if you're an authority figure.
You'll sound so smart and high, and you'll also, like, maybe that when they do the people's mic thing, it'll be like our words through your words and then echoed by the crowd, and it'll be a real moment for all of us.
Yeah, don't do that, but do go to the camps. You and I both visited a couple camps.
Yeah, we did.
You want to tell your story first?
Yeah, no, I don't have a really huge story, but last weekend I was going to the ball game with my dad up in the Bronx. Shout out to my dad. And my dad, as it turns out, has been reading a lot of Chomsky for a while, and this, you know, Gaza crisis, this atrocity, this genocide, my father was very touched by it. So he said, let's meet up in Manhattan and we'll go over to the Columbia protest. So this was like last week when things were like a little bit more calm. It was before the arrests, I think it was, or maybe it was like after.
It was after the first arrests were like a couple days into it, and then they reoccupied, and now they're talking about arresting them again.
Okay, right. So, like, by the time this comes out, they may well be arrested again.
Right, it might be going down right now.
Actually, people had been arrested at that point, but there were protesters outside, and the first thing I saw immediately was another person. She looked like an Arab American young woman in a keffiyeh, was getting frog marched into the paddy wagon. So The arrests were continuing, but pretty good energy out there. And inside, you could hear the chants and the drum circles, like where they wouldn't let us in because they were checking all the IDs and whatever. So how about you? You guys ran into some protest activities?
Yeah, we went to the they set it up on Saturday in New Orleans, a camp in Jackson Square, like right in the heart of the tourist district.
Nice.
And when we went a couple hours after they set it up. There was like maybe 15 tents there, maybe 40 participants roaming around, talking to people, really good banners, both in the park and then around the park. So it was a pretty good public presence. The response from people passing by seemed positive. Obviously, there's a lot of chuds are getting drunk through New Orleans, but
yeah,
they seem to just gawk at it from what we saw. And then we went to a Palestine benefit show at a bar. And during the last band, we heard that the camp was getting raided and we headed back there. But by then, it was already too late.
So New Orleans is kind of going off right now.
Wasn't going off, but there was an interesting scene set when we arrived, because I think I saw about six cops at Jackson Square just sort of milling about, standing around. But there was also a proposal being set up in Jackson Square, like these big lighted letters that spelled out "Marry Me," a red carpet. There were photographers. There was nice. Like a engagement like event coordinator with a headset, and it by the time we got to Jackson Square to see what had happened, all the letters were scattered about, and I think they were used as in self defense, perhaps.
Yeah. Oh man!
At one point, there's just some footage.
New type of anti riot shield created, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, but
so within the resistance, there was a moment of love and caring and marriage. That's really nice.
It was just very strange to see this proposal about to happen while there's an occupation in the park, and there's the proposal is playing their own music, and then there's other music. I don't know. The whole thing was just
so it wasn't like an occupier who was proposing to another occupier. No. It was just some random ass people trying to get married.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I gotcha. Yes. I gotcha. Well, quite a contrast right there.
Yeah.
But we're back, and as the producer, I think it's my duty to announce that we're going to be doing a Q&A episode today, a special May Day Q&A episode here. So we got ourselves some awesome questions from the Discord. If you're not a patron, you're not in the Discord, but the Discord is where our people go to do book clubs and send us questions and chat with one another and all that good stuff. So thank you to our questioners, our inquisitors out there for giving us these wonderful ones. What should we start with, Andy? What do you think? Should we start with a fun one? Wasn't there one about like sci-fi?
Yeah. What's your favorite proletarian sci-fi horror film? And why is it Alien? That's from Zephosaura.
Well, I mean, they already said that it's Alien. Probably I'll go with the one that I've seen the most and I was most obsessed with as a kid, and it's proletarian as fuck. It's The Abyss. Did you ever see James Cameron's The Abyss?
No, I haven't, unfortunately.
You never saw it?
I really should.
Oh, we should watch it sometime. It's the story of there's a Russian submarine like off the coast of the United States, and something mysterious happens and it crashes like under the water. So it was an American submarine, sorry. So an American like crack team of like Navy divers has to get down there to secure the nuclear weapons. In order to do that, you know, they need help from like civil society, from capital. So they like find this like deep like drilling rig. That's like, this is like kind of a fantasy part of it, because in this like new technique that they use, the drill rig, like all the people are like 1,000 feet under the ocean and they're drilling down there. Long story short is there's all these proletarians down there and they're like divers, you know, they're like marine construction workers, and they end up having to host these Navy SEALs who get increasingly crazy, because what they don't realize is that that mysterious thing was underwater flying objects like UFOs, alien types, and like basically all these proles who are like, you know, spitting and shitting and like twisting wrenches and whatever have to save the world. And if you haven't seen it, it is like really, really dope. And there's cool ass alien shit. It's like as cool as alien stuff in that as like Contact or something.
I had no idea. And I love James Cameron. But it's up my alley. So I need to see it. When did it come out?
Came out like 1989. And I remember that because I saw it. I think I managed to like convince my parents to take me to the theater. And then I read the, you know, the movie adaptation into book thing, that really corny thing where they like just take a screenplay and they turn it into a book. I read it and I was like obsessed with it. I think I've seen that movie like 20 times in my life. It's up there with like Ghostbusters.
Wow. I need to watch
That's another proletarian sci-fi.
Oh, it's prole as fuck, yeah.
If you include firefighters as proles.
Oh, we, of course. We do. Yeah. We do that.
Are we going to do yours?
Oh, yeah. Mine is Snowpiercer.
All right. Classic choice. Yeah. Powerful choice.
I love it. I show it to everyone who hasn't seen it. And I've watched a couple video essays on YouTube about the Willy Wonka theory. That
What is that?
It's like a sequel, or it's like the same plot as Willy Wonka.
It's in the Willy Wonka extended universe.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Cool.
Yes. They're like 45 minutes long. They explain great length. And I think they even confronted the director and he was kind of like, you got me.
That's fun.
I like that idea. Yeah. That's cool. I should watch one of those. See, we're all getting things that we can, you know.
But do you think we should pull the emergency brake even though we'll all die?
Yes.
Okay.
The train must jump the tracks.
Walter Benjamin over here, right? Pulling the brake lever on the engine of history. I'm with that, man. I am with
That's what the movie's about. That's why it's so good.
That's the Luddite option that Andy's into, right? When like abolishing the internet is like pulling the e-brake.
I'm going to go with Fire on the Mountain, which is a novel by Terry Bisson, which is about an alternate history or an alternate future, actually, where the raid on Harper's Ferry was successful and America is a non-white supremacist socialist utopia. And I think, I don't remember exactly what happens in it, but it's like there's a dystopian novel about our reality in it.
Oh, shit. Like that book that some friends wrote a couple of years ago that was like the New York Commune, but like from the future.
Right, right.
Right. So it's like a speculative fiction inside of a speculative fiction. That's,
yeah, yeah.
That's really dope.
Along those lines.
That sounds cool as hell.
All right.
That's a great question. That really lets us nerd out. And all you Abyss fans, please sign off in the comments. We got Ed Harris. We got... I think that's about it. Just Ed Harris is the only famous person in that. But it's very like represents like the multicultural, like multiracial working class too.
The submarine always reminds me of Das Boot, which is fiction, but a submarine.
I never saw Das Boot. Should I?
You should. Yeah. It's super long. I think I watched the extended cut of it, but I was gripped.
Okay.
I was like, what's this boring fucking submarine movie? Like, I don't want to watch this.
Is that Eisenstein that did Das Boot?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I'm like not really that good at film stuff. Let's move on from films because I'm showing my ignorance.
The rest of the questions are not quite as fun as that one.
Yeah, that's all right.
Well, here's one related to what we were just talking about from Kobaz BJ. General question on how we should conceive of the obviously limited but frequently present role of students in political and or class struggle and university occupation as a tactic. I know you all have some experience. Oh, we sure do.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so it is interesting to look at these occupations in the light of the occupation we are a part of at New School and NYU, and then the occupation wave in through the UC system.
And the failed occupation of Hunter College.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that?
On March 4th.
Yeah.
A lesser chapter in that history.
Wow, yeah, because we got undermined by Trots.
We got owned by the Trots.
Yeah, the Trots really knew how to use that drum effectively to get everybody shut down.
But that's actually an instructive story because that was against these, I think there was tuition increases in CUNY, and
tuition.
Also they were installing card readers.
They were installing, and they were shut, because there was a social reproductive element too, they were also shutting down one of the free daycares for students who had kids.
Mm.
Like, there was being turned into, like, some bullshit.
So this is around 2010, right?
Yeah, like maybe 6 months before Occupy Wall Street.
Well, it was longer than that. But, yeah, it would have been in the spring of 2010. And there was a plan to occupy one of, the main Hunter building in a similar fashion as students had at New School twice and at NYU, which were really, I mean, they were, the police responded to this in a way probably exceeding how they're responding to these protests now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they called a code Cobra on the second New School occupation, which was like,
terrorists.
What, 25 kids, including Sean, in a building. And they treated it as like a terrorist hostage situation with helicopters, hundreds of cop cars, and arrested and beat up people outside. Yeah. The effect was the same. They arrested the students, but they treated it as like a massive threat. And So I think going into the hunter occupation, there were a lot of fears from the more, I don't know, mainstream student groups and not the ultra-left psychos like us, that an indoor occupation would cause havoc or, you know, be counter-effective in some way. And so there was this tension between people who were there to have a ongoing occupation inside the building, to take control of the building, because that was our big tactical insistence, was one, no demands, but that was like kind of wishy-washy.
And that came out of California too.
No, well, we had no demands for the second occupation, but the central demand was Bob Kerry resign.
Right.
But yeah, so we were pretty insistent on no demands, and then also occupation as an end in itself.
Mm.
And occupation meaning like we control the building, like we control the entrances and exits. We're going to start running it. We're going to start having classes there, that kind of thing. And they ended up doing that throughout the UC system for quite a long period of time, especially in Santa Cruz. And so now with the student occupations in that begin in these in the quad, there's text circulating. One was published by Ill Will called When You Take Columbia, which are these lessons from the occupation movement in California and elsewhere.
Cool. I didn't see that.
And they're being widely distributed, and they've caused some controversy in some of these camps because the more organized left, or like they say Maoist, but I don't know if they mean Maoist or just like normal leftist organizers, want this to be a certain kind of tactic. And people who want to occupy buildings, obviously, that's a major escalation.
Yeah.
But I think it's a necessary escalation.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a 68 escalation, right? Because that happens in 1968.
Sure. And because what are these camps really demanding? Sure, they're demanding divestment and sanctions of Israel and to pressure the U.S. government to like force a ceasefire.
Mm-hmm.
But what are we finding when they're making these demands in totally peaceful ways, in ways that are very concerned with the optics of not sounding anti-Semitic?
And very much in like the liberal conception of what the university is there for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to make your voice heard and to create community and to fight for the things that you believe in.
What are we finding is that administrators and politicians and the media are roundly saying these protests are unacceptable.
Anti-Semitic.
What you're saying is unacceptable. No matter what you're saying, we're going to call you anti-Semitic, and we're going to justify any amount of police violence to suppress you.
Mm-hmm.
So the contradiction there is not so much between like the people who want a ceasefire and the government who doesn't, but in the very structure of the university, where it's run by a board of trustees that is totally disinterested in anything, in the university being used in any way that's social or socially conflictual.
Yeah, I mean, the university, more so now than at any time, is basically like a hedge fund with like desks and some like teaching supplies, right? These are like huge non-profit but multi-billion-dollar institutions, and their role has shifted over the years. It began teaching the children of the ruling class, and then in the 60s and 70s they became like, you know, a place that working class proletarian people would send their kids so they could have a better life. Now universities and a university degree doesn't do what it used to really do anymore. And college is a place where, you know, a lot of the dreams and conceptions of what college was in the 20th century, people are going there to be disappointed largely. And they're turning into like, basically like training camps for wage labor in the future. So it's like not surprising that universities remain a site of struggle. It's no surprising that a lot of the political conflicts of society are raging in these particular institutions. And I guess the question we have to wonder as this school year winds down, and as maybe a lot of this energy goes towards Chicago, right? The Democratic National Convention, if these atrocities are still happening in Gaza, that is going to pop off just like it did in 1968 again.
Yeah, for sure.
The question is like, you know, students, new students come in all the time, and there's like a renewal of this activist and like organizer activity and like the minority that is leftist on campus. But like now that we've seen what the United States government is capable of supporting in the Middle East, now that we see that like voting for the non-fascist gives you like ethnic cleansing and fucking genocide, now that so many people have seen this, as they move out of a university life and into their working lives, what do they take with them? And I think that's an interesting question, because I think a lot of people have been very, very radicalized over this. So we'll see what happens.
That just reminded me that one of the great texts that came out of the UC occupations was Communique from an Absent Future, that talked about the declining professional prospects for grads, and that's only gotten worse.
Oh, yeah.
And like the kind of bullshit jobs that millennials have found themselves into are going away or like becoming far less paid, far more untenable. So I guess what I'm getting at with this is there's been some very good, maybe intersectional analyses about what these camps are about. Like I heard that interview on Chapo with one of the Columbia student protesters. And a lot of the time she talked about the way Columbia is gentrifying Harlem and always has and seeks to do it even more. So that's obviously true with NYU. NYU and Columbia are two of the biggest real estate holders in New York, if not Absolutely. The biggest. So they have power that's far larger than simply an academic institution, and they deserve to be critiqued on that level for their ties to Israel, for wanting to build campuses in Israel, and
for their ties to the military industrial complex and R&D for murder machines.
But then also the way that they control life in New York, and what would it mean if the university were run by the people who work there instead of the investors? And that's just an obvious direction for this movement to go in, I think.
And look, you know, and I'm not even being ironic or edgy right here, like the university is already showing itself to be like a self-abolishing institution, right? Like the things that made it like a valuable civil social part of society are now kind of crumbling. Or at least it's becoming more jagged around the edges. And so ultimately we have to imagine a world beyond the university. You know, what would a communist education system look like? How could we imagine taking, as Andy said, these powers into our own hands, and what would that actually look like? These are real hot button questions, and I'm not saying that the nucleus of that is necessarily in the quad of like an Ivy League university and, you know, the most expensive real estate in the entire world, but it's not a part of that, right? And I think we have to commend all the people out there who are doing good work to try to stop this terrible, terrible war, and hats off to all of you people out there.
Let's do another political one, and then I did find some other fun ones we could ask.
All right.
From Fade, what's your guys' thoughts on the proletariat being conceived as a milieu of the downtrodden, i.e. Sakai, Dave, etc., rather than people who live and die on wage labor?
That's Andy's shit right there. I think Andy said on the podcast that he believes in that. I'm not sure that I do, honestly. I'm not even sure... like Marx himself, I'm not even sure that we can define working class except in like a very systemic sense, like in the abstract. I'm not saying it's a you know it when you see it thing, but I think that Andy is a proponent of this theory, right? A proletarian is one who engages in struggle,
right?
Not working. There's a distinction between that.
Yeah, so the working class would be an objective categorization. If you identify with a worker or not, if you're a wage earner and you don't own capital or you don't command labor, you're working class. Even if you're not a wage earner, you know, there's a lot of people who don't earn wages and are working class as well. But it's not something you choose. It's something that's foisted on to you, and it's not a good thing. Proletariat are the people who are actively engaged in the real movement to abolish class society. And that also includes people who aren't wage earners. It probably includes some middle-class people, D-class A people, even bourgeois people, like Engels, for example. It's something you can join and opt into, and it's a positive project.
Yeah. I'm actually with that. I don't know. Like I said in the beginning, I don't have any strong takes on this one way or the other, but I think that there's like what's heroic, of course, about the proletarian, or what's like potential about the proletarian is that they have nothing to lose except their chains, right? That old saw. But, you know, I think that to the extent that like workers can attain some sort of like revolutionary enlightenment, like, thought and action, I think that's when the proletariat comes into existence for itself. I think we've all worked with that guy who's like the Renaissance man, right? You ever work with that guy who like knows everything and he's just like on the line in the kitchen or like they're doing some other bullshit?
Yeah, they can build anything, they can fix anything.
Yeah, they have like a wide range of interests. I mean, like that's the kind of proletarian we need to become, maybe empty of... Yeah. empty of capital, like lacking in the means to reproduce ourselves except for wage labor, but being as much of an all-around person and individual within a community as you could possibly be.
Yeah, I will say that the problem with the definition as I've defined it is like this question alludes to, it sort of comes from Davey and more ultra-left thinkers. And so when you read historical Marxist writing, including Marx on the proletariat, he doesn't use the word in this sense. So you're kind of falsifying the term to some extent.
But it doesn't, I mean, Marx can be wrong about things and you can be right about
things. It's not so much that he's wrong. It's just that if we're defining communism as the real movement that abolishes the present state of things that exists today and is an ongoing process, then communists exist today. They're part of the real movement. Mm-hmm. So it's a different way of conceiving the proletariat that could be helpful, but might not be historically accurate.
Yeah. Or you could just like do the classic hedge and be like, in Marx's time, it meant one thing, but because of the imminent dynamics of capital accumulation, now it means something completely different. And you could write a whole book about that, maybe get an academic job. I don't know.
I definitely would use proletariat and working class interchangeably, but I feel like definition is more...
It's more fun.
It's more fun. Yeah.
It's good to be fun about it. Yeah. I mean, what else are we here for except to have fun?
Yep. We can do a fun question now.
Yeah. Is it what's your favorite? Is it the one from Dave Tool Using
Mammal? Yeah, that's a good one.
All right. Dave, our friend, Tool Using Mammal.
What's oi up, to Dave.
Yes. Oi, oi, oi. What is your favorite beer, shot, bar food combo? Example, and I think this one's close to his heart, Budweiser, Jameson, and cheeseburger. Also, how do we push Biden to the left? You know, when I was a young man, I used to be like a JMO guy. Know JMO and like a Budweiser or a JMO and I don't know, it's like a Yinling. You know, JMO and Yinling go really, really great together. But I worked with this old timer and he's like, kid, you're over 30 years old and you're still drinking brown liquor, you're fucking nuts. It's like, once you get to be my age, and he's like 55, he's like, you gotta stick with the clear shit. He's like, no, not everybody likes vodka, I understand. There's always tequila. You like tequila? And I'm like, yeah, I tequila's great. He's like, do yourself a favor, kid. Next time you go to the bar to get a shot and a beer, get the tequila. And then he was right. And from there on, I mixed it up. It's like the hangovers. It's just completely different. You'll feel fine the next day.
Yeah, if it's a good tequila, you'll have less of a hangover for sure.
Yeah. So I guess like Bud and tequila. And then for bar food, I'm not a big bar food guy. Like bar food tends to make me not feel good. I have a pretty strong stomach, but like really greasy French fries and stuff like that, I don't know. It doesn't always sit so right with me. I'll have some peanuts.
For me, any Fernet combo, if I can get a shot of Fernet with something for $10.
Yeah.
Usually it'll be a pretty good beer if it's going to be with Fernet. And then I love the vegan nachos at Aunt Jenny's.
Shout out to
Aunt
Jenny's.
That's the only bar food I can think of that I really like.
You know, I remember when Fernet, it was like 15 years ago, people started, like all the people in the bar and restaurant industry started drinking it. My friend Zev was a huge Fernet guy, and he tried to turn me on to it, but that's not my kind of thing.
Yeah, Fernet, the company, made a big push directed towards Brooklyn bartenders.
Oh, okay, all right.
And
it's like Thai food in the...
And so now if you go to Argentina, where they actually... The only other country where they actually drink Fernet, and you just order a straight Fernet or a shot of Fernet, they'll be like, oh, you're from Brooklyn, because we're the only people in the world who drink it that way.
You know what I drank for the first time in Chicago, though, was Maldorf? Or
Malort.
Malort.
New Orleans, yeah.
Dog shit. It tasted terrible.
It was awful.
The server was like, we have this like Chicago special drink thing. And I was like, yeah, it doesn't sound like something I like. He's like, well, you never had it before. You're not from here. Like, let me just give you some. And so I took it and I grimaced and he's like, that's about right.
See, I like Malort.
Okay.
I imagine it tastes like the stuff they put on batteries so babies don't swallow.
It kind of is. I mean, it was drinkable. Like, it wasn't like drinking poison, but I think that'll probably be my last time.
I like the way batteries taste.
Andy was one of those kids that used to put the 9-volt battery
on definitely.
His tongue. Pretty fun.
I did. Is that wrong? Is that so wrong?
It's not wrong. It's like a little mini shock treatment when you're feeling down, you know?
And so how do we push Biden to the left? You have to make him very afraid.
Yeah.
And given how little fear he's shown and the fact that his entire voting base has dramatically turned against him and he does not care, he's going to have to be a lot more afraid. And the last time we saw the government extremely afraid was the George Floyd uprising.
Yeah. So something
that's how we do it.
Something on that caliber. Yeah.
I think one could hypothetically push Biden to the left by making sure the Secret Service is far away and charging him really fast.
Just, like, there's a joke there. Like, how do you push Biden to the left? A strong wind.
Yeah. That would be good on a banner.
It would be, yeah. A strong wind. And then just show him, like, teetering and tottering. I mean, he's an old man. I get it. We all lose our balance when we're older. But he's also the most powerful person in the world.
One fall is keeping us from President Kamala Harris.
Oh, my God.
We need President Kamala so bad.
What the fuck is our podcast going to do during election season? Like, how are we going to survive election season? Why are we just going to counter-program the whole time? We probably should. That's what we did last time.
We're going to be anti-Trumpists.
Oh, cool. We're going to do the resistance part, too.
Yeah. Jaylen and I have a theory that part of the reason the Gen X and boomers have gone so psychotically anti-woke and, like, have just become so brain broken is because Jon Stewart went off the air in late 2015. Yeah. We needed his voice for the 2016 election. We needed his voice of liberal reason.
Yeah.
And that is so obvious now. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm stealing your theory. Okay. This is Jaylen's theory, but I just love it so much that, When Jon Stewart's back now on, like, Mondays, and he's talking about Israel-Palestine, and he's not coming up with the solutions that I would agree with, but he is facing the question, which is so much better than 90% of the media. Politicians aren't doing it. Everyone is just in some state of denial about it because they know we can't actually break ties with Israel.
Right.
And if we were to call Israel genocidal and demand a two-state solution or, like, some sort of intervention in the conflict, that's just, like, a non-starter for anyone who, like, has any stake in the American empire. And so Jon Stewart is able to, like, be a liberal and be like, this is what's going on. Here's my jokes and my liberal solution about it. And it's incredibly refreshing if you compare it to, like, Bill Maher or, like, even Trevor Noah, who came before him, or, like, Stephen Colbert. Like, you're not getting a serious, entertaining look at it. I guess John Oliver does a little bit, but he's way cornier than Jon Stewart.
Yeah, that's a good theory. So you're saying that what we were missing was Jon Stewart, and now he's back and the liberals can, like, get their, like, the release the pressure valve, and somebody can be, like, a super lib but still critique Biden. So, like, it's gonna help.
Only on Mondays, just one night a week.
Yeah. So one special night a week. So he does, like, a whole roundup of the whole week. I'll have to watch it sometime. I don't watch too much TV these days, but
That said, I think we probably won't do it on this episode, but, like, I found a really funny article about Trump's youth that I want to read at some point.
Oh, sure.
Because I think we should go back to Orange Man Bad.
Yo, that's how we're coming around.
We, like, shouldn't
pass the cynicism and pass the, like, it doesn't make any difference, and back to, like,
Russia, Russia, Russia.
Yeah, hell yeah. I like that. We should do, like, Women's March Part 2.
Definitely.
And we should do...
We need a Women's March.
We do. Yeah, I'm not being ironic. Let's play that one back. We could do that that strike at the airport again from the taxi workers.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
I mean, it's going to be deeply embarrassing when these things come back and they just didn't exist under Biden.
Yeah.
But we need it one way or another.
Well, the kids are going back in cages, okay?
Yeah.
The kids left the cages under Biden. He fixed the border, made it fair. The kids are going back in cages.
They're going, to less kinder, gentler cages, which won't be difficult. They won't have to change the cages too much to make it meaner.
Yeah, Obama's, Biden's, and Trump's cages are kind of similar. Do you want to do the really long and involved one?
Yeah, let's get that.
All right, let's get that one. And then I've been going since 5:30 this morning. I might have to call it after this.
All right.
This is from Zephosora. Thank you, Zephosora, for the question. I'm sorry, but this is a long mess of questions. Feel free to break it up and only address parts or ignore me, LOL.
We did not break it up.
No, we're going to do the whole thing.
We just didn't do it.
Yeah, we didn't break it up. Also, you did this. You can live with the consequences. Take some responsibility in your life, goddammit.
You want me to break it up for you? Come on.
Yeah, come on. Sean has expressed quite a bit of interest in social republicanism, inspired, I assume, by talks with Cutrone, Marxist Unity Group, McNair, and William Clay Roberts. I'm curious, Andy, if you guys are on the same page. either way, I think it would be interesting to hear you guys go into that topic some. Like, what key things prompted this apparent shift in orientation? Now, see this, we actually do have to break it up. Like, okay. It would have been funny to not break it up, but these are like individual questions. So, Andy, what's your take on all this?
I mean, I do think that there is something in recognizing the parts of the American political society and the American Revolution and the Civil War and the conception of American democracy and like the sort of specific anti-elitism. Mm. Even in the militia movement, you see this anti-government, we're not going to let them take our guns stuff that communists basically agree with. And the fact that these things go to the right is a very challenging question. But I generally agree that politics of we need to burn America down appeal to a very small minority of people.
Yeah,
I think there's a sort of conception that people of color agree with that, which I
Not
don't think is accurate.
Not the ones I work with.
So I don't think we should be waving American flags and identifying as patriotic and American, because that would be a lie to me. But I do think a more thoroughgoing appraisal of the contradictions of American history is important. Now, that said, we've interviewed McNair and Mugg, and I see their project as not being much different than DSA, which is fine. Like, I'm not against the DSA, but it's just not my politics. I think the idea of, like, non-reformist reforms and, like, working within the American representative democratic system is not going to go anywhere. And so I have no problem with what they're doing, but I don't really believe in that. And I think what we're trying to do in ILC is, you know, information. We're still having like theoretical discussions about what we mean by certain terms. And so I think it's too early to say like what we bring to the table with this yet. But I do agree with this question of towards you, Sean, of like how you went in this direction and like what's your interest in it?
Yeah. So that's the next part of the question. What did you discard from your early insurrectionary communizer type orientation and what would you retain? Do you have any notable critiques? Or we'll do critiques and actually Andy started the critiques. Do you have any notable critiques or modifications to the new wave of social Republican discourse? I'll take that one first. I actually agree with Andy that like the Mug project and the McNair project and what others are trying to like bring out in social republicanism does fall flat to me, which is why ILC is kind of different. There's like a term that I don't know if I came up with it, but like politicalism, you know, that exists right now where there's these sort of like disembodied ideas of like, you know, form a new constitution, have a new constitutional convention or start a new party or a new sect and have the right line or whatever, that I think is premature at this point in time. You know, I think that the movement towards these serious politics is also interesting, right? So what did I discard and why was I drawn to these ideas? I mean, that's a really interesting question. It comes out of like something that I think I'm kind of proud of myself for doing, which is every time something new happens, like a new moment in history or a new series of conflicts and problems that we have to address, I try to sit down and look at them and be like, how does this affect like the things that I believe and how do I reconsider those things? And I felt like a real lack existed in my own politics. And actually, you know, if I could give Mugg and Donald Parkinson specifically credit, last summer I read an article of his that like excoriated left-com communizer types who were just like waiting for the crisis to happen as though something automatic is going to come from like economic breakdown. And I'm like, yeah, that's kind of me. Like, what do I do with the fact that there is no like acute crisis right now? How do I start to think proactively about politics in a new way? And I feel like the republicanism stuff really grabbed at me from a direction that I've been kind of tearing at for a long time, which is like Andy was saying with the militia, like militia stuff being right-wing coded, but also having some sort of like seemingly positive value that we might excavate from it. You know, I've been seeing the same thing for years among like my blue-collar fellow tradespeople, right? Where there is this like fighting spirit, this like real like upright, like bearing of like, this is our craft, you know, the company can't take this from us, you know, like we're in this together and like all that, like we do is get shit on by the company and they're taking everything away and we're going to fight and we fight and we fight for what we can. Like, how do I reconcile that with like the politics of, you know, communization or whatever? Well, it's like, you have to get it to the root of like why it is that even people who otherwise might have no politics or like right wing politics are so willing to like stand by, but next to like a black or a brown brother, you know, or a sister and like fight with them on the line. And with that, I just thought, like, we can't take that for granted. We can't take this conception of rights for granted. Where does it arise historically? And then when I read the William Clare Roberts and then, you know, other texts too, I started to see this valence of republicanism as being as important to understanding like politics and culture, which I'm allergic to, and like society in a similar way for me to like what the value form explains in the way that like their everyday lives work and the wage relation or whatever. It's like this deeply rich way of understanding changes that have happened over the last 200-300 years that's like intricately tied to political economy, but is able to answer a lot of questions that, like, say, reading the first 3 chapters of Capital a million times doesn't really give you. And, like, there are different ways that people have gone with it, but it's, like, for me, it's, like, a really interesting research project and one that I was excited enough with that, like, I was able to grab some people together, like Andy and a bunch of other great people, and it's a research project that we're going to, like, try to solve through practice, which is, like, really exciting because I was certainly feeling, like, pretty morbid over the politics of the last few years because they've been pretty, pretty bad. So, you know, I think it's exciting. And what do I keep from the communizer type stuff? I mean, I kind of like still believe all that stuff. I don't think that it's like necessarily mutually exclusive. I think there is something about like, say, workers' councils, right? Or like communes that have arisen, which are like potentially deeply like implicated in like bourgeois revolutionary traditions overcoming themselves.
The problem with doing a little a la carte,
like, yes,
making what works for you.
And then another part of the question, how do you see stuff like Phil and Nick's Forest and Factory with a vision of total transformation of society and production in relation to more conservative social republican ideas of revolutionary organization and strategy? I mean, they reference, or at least Nick Chavez does, I think, in that piece, the Republican theories of Marx as interpreted through William Clare Roberts. So they actually helped me, because I respect them both as thinkers and as revolutionaries. That actually allowed me to take it more seriously when I'm like, people who already share these other type of politics are also taking this like social republicanism seriously. So I thank them for that, kind of opening up that vista for me. And I think like the total transformation stuff, you know, there's going to be in this chaotic transitionary period and this like complete overturning of things, a way in which like the basis of like enlightenment thought will no longer be this like abstraction of like citizen and law or whatever, but like will be brought down to earth and not abolished, but like overcome on its own terms. So, and I think that, you know, it seems like we've moved past the workers' council form. You know, what's like something bigger than 1905? What's a way that like the gains of 1905 and 1917 could be expanded beyond certain workplaces, certain locales, and certain industries and certain nations? And maybe the clue to that is kind of understanding the way that the like bourgeois revolutionary tradition would, and I talk about America a lot in the Left Undead piece, but like as somebody pointed out in the Platypus Convention, it's a really good point, is that the Republican movement of like the 17th, 18th, 19th century was a transatlantic and global movement, right? You had in 1912, you had a bourgeois revolution in China, right? So this like revolutionary tradition isn't just in America. And there was from its outset something international and internationalist about it. So like that's what we have to grab onto, that, and then imagine how that could help us transform, say, like the distinction between the economic and political itself.
And that sort of brings up Zipho Sura's follow-up question, which was about the Paris Commune. And they ask, how do people envision up scaling up the idea of the Paris Commune as the social republic? Do you preserve nations and borders, or envision something more like a web of regional coordination? Seems like age-old issues of centralized political organization versus autonomous federation are still open questions.
I mean, the cooperative commonwealth, right, on a world scale, something like not a world state, but like some manner of like world governance that would be based on representation, but not the kind of like quasi-democratic structures we have now, but with recallable delegates and like society consciously deliberating, debating, and deciding on what it is that it will produce and the ways that it'll reproduce itself and the world. I mean, that's the world commune, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Forest and Factory is a good speculative piece about what that could look like. And I'm not sure, as fun as it is, it doesn't feel to me like it's offering anything too new or tangible, but these experiments in envisioning what communism could look like are, you know, at minimum fun. And that's what we're all about here, as we established earlier.
That's right. The fun and organizing. Should we finish maybe with Cody's question to Andy? How's the baseball book going? Any fun anecdotes to share?
So many. So much. They're fun for me. I don't know if they're fun for anyone else.
He's deep in the archive, and he's going to opening day, and he's doing his whole thing.
I'd say one fun, relevant thing is that right before this season started, there was a class war within the MLB Players Association, the Players Union, because in 2021, 2022... the minor league players unionized, which is something that people really thought could never happen for so many reasons. Like, players are constantly shifted from club to club, and there's like a huge language barrier in the clubhouse, and players are terrified if they step out of line that they won't get promoted. But the minor leaguers were paid so horrendously, living in horrible conditions, you know, eating one fast food meal a day, living in their cars, stuff like that. And they, through some legislation that allowed MLB to underpay them, passed in 2016. And then from the way they were treated during the pandemic, where they were basically just all laid off with no negotiation, they had enough. And through some creative organizing work, they unionized, affiliated with the MLBPA. But that is totally changes the composition of the MLBPA, which was once only the major leaguers, and led largely by their stars, the highest paid players. And there was allegations of influence from the agents in like the way the kind of
price fixing,
the voting, sort of the voting committee or whatever, the executive committee of players makes their decisions and enters into negotiations. So now there's 5,000 more players involved, and they have a nearly equal voting share for contract negotiations.
That's amazing, because it's like the present and the future of the league now, the players represent. Wow.
And so apparently there was a Zoom call in the last week of spring training where the majority of players said that they were against the current main lead negotiator, a labor lawyer guy who's also represented the NBA and I think hockey as well. And they wanted him out.
Mercenary motherfucker, right?
They wanted him out in exchange for the guy who unionized the minors, Harry Marino, who was a labor lawyer, who was an ex-baseball player, minor leaguer. And hard for me to say exactly what it was about, but it was largely about the belief that the union is being led by the top stars, in the interest of the top stars. And there was some desire for some kind of distribution of power and wealth throughout the entire professional baseball association.
So it's like a rank and file movement now, basically.
Yep.
Wow, that's sick.
And they failed to make that switch, but the pressure is definitely going to put the MLBPA in a different direction leading up to their next CBA negotiations, which is in 2 years.
Oh, hell yeah. So you'll, I'm sure, be covering that. And
it's going to be really fascinating to see how it plays out.
So in answer to your question then, to summarize what Andy said, baseball book's going great. Lots of good anecdotes. You got to wait till not next year, but the year after. It'll be coming out. We'll all read it.
I'll hint at one more, which is that Doc Gooden's number was recently retired at Citi Field. And not mentioned in anything that I read in these retrospectives of Doc Gooden was that him and Gary Sheffield in 1986, after he wins the World Series, are pulled over for driving while black in Tampa, Florida, and brutally beaten and had racial slurs yelled at them.
Oh my gosh.
And at one point, a cop even tried to break Gooden's pitching arm, knowing who he was.
What?
And they, you know, they were charged with assaulting an officer and all that. And they told their side of the story. And, you know, obviously people didn't believe them. They were like, well, why were you mouthing off to an officer?
Yeah, this is 1986. Kind of
stuff. Yeah. If it wasn't for one white couple passing by and seeing the attack and hearing what the officers were saying, hearing them use the N-word, that might have ended his career, because he might have gotten that conviction. Instead, he sued the police department and won.
Wow. Holy cow. I didn't know that. Gary Sheffield, man, that guy had a cannon from right field.
Yeah,
I used to love watching him play.
And Sheffield's a very outspoken player about being a black baseball player in a time when there's very few African-American baseball players left. And there's a lot to say about that.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more to say about Doc Gooden. He was also credibly accused of being part of a date rape in 1991. So there's a lot more to the story that people just sort of glossed over, but it'll be in the book.
It'll be in the book. Read the ball book. Read the ball book.
All right. I know you're tired, but one more question for you, one.
I can sleep in a little bit tomorrow because the job's pretty close.
From PWJ.
All right.
What did you do with the Are You a Communist sticker I gave you after the comedy show thing in Brooklyn? Did you put it in your bathroom mirror and look at it every day, or did it get trashed?
I didn't trash it. I promise you that. I didn't look at it and go, ugh, disgusting, and throw it in the fucking garbage. What likely happened to it, because I read that on the subway on the way home from work today, is in the course of our move, it got misplaced somewhere, or maybe it's in
it got
like,
trashed.
It didn't get trashed. Trashed implies I was like, and I threw it out. It's probably somewhere in this apartment. I mean, you guys are here now. It's like kind of like a pretty decently sized apartment. It could be anywhere here. Yeah. Maybe we'll all three of us now, since we've got our days finished, can all go look for the sticker. We can have a little treasure hunt, like trying to find the Afikoman, you know?
At least you didn't draw little devil horns on it, which I've seen on a lot of those
stickers. The ones on I see them on the subway all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what you could do, PWJ, is come out to our, if you're listening to it, to this on May Day. We are having a barbecue in McCarran Park, followed by a screening of Anti-Banality Movies, which is a really cool anarchistish, communistish film collective at Woodbine, and then we'll have some speeches and a party afterwards at Woodbine. So 3 to 7 in McCarran Park today, May Day, 7 to 11 at Woodbine. And at Woodbine, there'll be speeches from the ILC.
Yes.
There'll be speeches from Stop Cop City and somebody from the Columbia Occupation.
Oh, we got that. That's
hopefully
great.
Will come as well.
Yeah, and shout out to all of our ILC friends. People have put a lot of work into throwing this together. If you're anywhere in like the tri-state area and you have a chance to come down, we'd love to meet you. We'd love to see you. And we'd like to give you more information about ILC in person, perhaps with drinks and veggie hot dogs in our hands. So hopefully we'll see you there.
I'll be there.
And there's an added incentive. We'll all be there. In that juicy vid, bitch, I can't motherfucking stop moving. Go against me, you won't stop losing. From the city where every month is May Day at home, spray a dome, niggas get sprayed up like AK was cologne for a paycheck alone. Yeah, I know that shit ain't fair. They say Detroit ain't got a chance, we ain't even got a mayor. You write your name with a sharpie, I write mine in stone. I knew the world was for the taking and wouldn't take long. We on trying to be better than everybody that's better than everybody. Rep Detroit, everybody, Detroit versus everybody. I'm so fucking first class, I can spit up on every pilot. The city's my metropolis, fill it, it's metabolic. And I'm over niggas saying they the hottest niggas, then run to the hottest niggas just to stay hot. I'm one of the hottest because I flame drop, drop fire, and not because I'm name dropping, Hall of Fame dropping. And I ain't taking shit from nobody unless they OGs, cause that ain't the way of a OG. So I G-O collect mo' G's, every dollar never changed though. I'm just a new version of old me, forever hot-headed but never got cold feet. Got up in the game, won't look back at my old seats. Click so deep, we take up the whole street. I need a bitch so bad that she take up my whole week. Shine down.